Mike Schmidt is a senior systems engineer at Heartland Video Systems, specializing in ATSC 3.0. He is responsible for the build-out of Heartland's ATSC 3.0 lab, designing the 3.0 systems during the sales process, and guiding HVS customers through ATSC 3.0 market launches. He also does ModCod development, setup, testing, and training customers on the actual equipment. Mike and HVS have been part of more than 40 ATSC 3.0 market launches. He also works with manufacturers on additional ATSC 3.0 technologies. He uses the HVS 3.0 lab to make sure that configurations work before implementing them for customers. Mike's background includes 20 years at HVS, mainly in encoding and PSIP equipment. Earlier in his career, he was in the U.S. Navy at Alameda, California, on the tender, the Samuel Gompers. He also worked with satellites at L3 Communications. So Mike is as outdoorsy as he is technical. He enjoys basketball, gardening, cooking, home brewing, backpacking, foraging, hiking, and just being out in the woods. Please welcome Mike Schmidt.
Thanks for having me, everyone. Mike Schmidt with Heartland Video Systems. I'm going to go over some basic ATSC 3 and then get into IP structure and how you might want to configure your networks. So the first thing is we've done quite a few launches, almost 50 now, including Los Angeles, Houston, Atlanta, Hartford, Detroit. So we've been an ATSC member for 2.5 years. We are heavily invested in doing ATSC 3 for our customers. I'm going to do a general review. First off, it's going to be the benefits of 3.0. So the first thing is OTA, OTT, hybrid services, and repair. The idea here is that if you signal a channel in your OTA stream, you can backfill the actual content OTT. And that is really important when you're doing a lighthouse, when you don't have a lot of bandwidth. OTT takes up, you know, 20, 24 megabits. The OTA signal can go out quite far if you design your ModCod. You can have like a 0 dB carrier to noise. That's going to give you the ability to have more viewers as long as they're broadband connected. Your encoder will send out a dash stream to a CDN, and when somebody receives you over the air, there's a table that'll point it to that CDN URL. The other aspect of that is that the OTA stream gives you like geofencing. So anybody that doesn't have the OTA signal can't subscribe to that stream. CDN charges per subscriber, and if it's outside of your viewing area, it's not doing you much good, it's costing you. So repair is the ability to send the same stream out OTT and OTA, and you can pick and choose what packets to use in case you have some interruptions. The next one is mobile. So there is the ability in ATSC 3 to, again, design your ModCod to have a low carrier to noise and a lower bandwidth, but also be mobile friendly. So you can hit cars at 70 miles an hour through tunnels in downtown areas with a lot of high rises. So the aspect of that is if you have your modulation and your FEC making a low carrier to noise, that's helpful to mobile. But there's also the number of carriers that you can transmit. There's called FFT, scattered pilot, and guard interval. And there are, you know, there's settings that are more mobile friendly in that, and there are settings that are more fixed, higher bandwidth. So it just depends on how you design your ModCod up, but you can hit mobile very easily. We also can support 4K and 1080p with HDR. 4K in OTA is kind of a tough ask, again, because it's higher bandwidth, but you can backfill it OTT. 1080p with HDR doesn't take up all that much bandwidth, like maybe 5 megabits. When you add HDR to the stream, you don't add a whole lot of headroom, but the benefit is pretty noticeable. HDR looks much better than SDR. That's a much more realistic thing to do, even in a Lighthouse model. There's also the audio aspect of AC4. There's a thing called enhanced dialogue that's native to AC4, and you enact that on a TV. So you can turn up your dialogue without turning up the rest of the audio components to make it easier to hear what people are saying. Might be useful in bars or, you know, just at your home if you have a lot of noise around. It supports Dolby Atmos, which is 5.1 plus 4, plus 4 being the overhead speakers, and the 7.1 plus 2 and plus 4. Most encoders will support AC4 at 5.1 only, so if you want to do some of the more advanced things, you have to have audio processing before the encoder. Kind of like in the old ATSC1 days where 5.1 wasn't supported natively, you'd have to use like a Dolby box to do advanced audio. Targeted ads, it's basically the ability to send out your ads that you want to air to the TVs as NRT data. So you just send in the background, nobody sees it, the TV stores it, and then you can do SCSI triggers to substitute what the TV already has in its memory and replace what's on. Data casting, because ATSC3 is all IP, it's very easy to insert into the system, the ability to do the mod cod so that you can have a data PLP that can reach a lot of people that you wouldn't normally be able to reach with your 1.0 is also pretty useful. Signal signing and encryption. Signal signing is the ability to put a certificate in your stream. It works with root certificates in consumer electronics devices. So if it's in the stream and the TV is mandating the certificate, if it's not right or not present, the TV won't render the video and the audio. It's really supposed to prevent people like Aereo and Locast from stealing your broadcast and using it for their benefit. And, you know, you can go to court and fight it, but they might be doing that for a couple of years on you. Now they won't be able to. Encryption is just, you know, the ability to scramble your signal. Think in the beginning, it's going to start off with you encrypt the signal and send decrypt keys for everything, so the viewer doesn't really know that it's happening. And that sets the stage for doing encryption on special channels, withholding the decode keys unless somebody pays for it. You might do that with your OTT service as a 4K, for instance. And then there's advanced emergency alerting, which does not take the place of EAS. You still are required to do the crawl with a voiceover, but this is the ability to use a DASDEC device to gather a bunch of different data as an XML file, and that gets sent out of your signaling server, and TVs can receive that. They can't render it without a broadcast app or a receiver app to, you know, actually act on that data, but it is another advancement in ATSC3. To talk a little bit more about signal signing, Ianti, which pairs with DigiCert, is the company that stations have to work with. This is mandatory in ATSC3. It's not optional. So you sign a contract with them, and they'll give you certificates that you put into your signaling server. The only person right now that needs to do that is the Lighthouse or the transmitter owner. Everybody else that might be part of that just gets grandfathered in. They get carried along. And the Lighthouse has to buy two certificates, a CDT and an SMT. That's 100%. If somebody is doing a true broadcast app, they have to buy an app distributor cert as well. Any app author has to certify their app. They certify it once, it can be used with any Lighthouse, provided the Lighthouse has the app distributor. And signal signing became possible on February 14th, 2022, this year. They called that the sunrise date. And the idea is broadcasters could start using it and making sure that it works fine. It's the TVs, the consumer electronics, are not supposed to enforce it, though. They just don't care if it's there or not right now. There's a certification program to go through, a verification program that Heartland actually helps A3SA with, to make sure it's going to work. And then there's a high noon date, some other, this is some TBD date in the future, where the TVs will actually mandate this. And at that point in time, if you don't have a certificate, you won't be on air. I'm not going to go over the status on consumer devices too much. Tom Michelson touched on this. All the devices pretty much work for video, audio, captions, guide data, signal signing, and DRM. There are a few little, you know, issues with all of them, but nothing major. Set-top boxes like VBox, ZapperBox, and HD Home Run are a good solution for not much money if you don't have a next-gen TV. You can use those to receive the next-gen and output an HDMI or stream to a, you know, a laptop or a cell phone. I'm going to go through an ATSC through chain and just kind of show you what kind of equipment we're talking about. Again, some of these slides are duplicated from Tom. I'm plagiarizing him. A bill of materials, I'll go through this pretty quickly. You need an encoder with a dash packager, so one RU server. You need a route MMT server, which is also a signaling server, I'll refer to it as, and a broadcast gateway. Those are the three main pieces for an ATSC 3 chain. You also need a good Stratum 1 hardware NTP, lock to GPS, and you might need some networking switches depending on how you decide to design your system. You need an IPSTL with maybe at the max 35 megabits capacity. It can be over that, but that's a pretty good number to start with. It doesn't have to be bidirectional, though. It can be. It's a UDP. It could be unidirectional. You can do that microwave. You can do it through fiber ISP. You have to be careful about STLTP traffic because it doesn't act as true multicast sometimes. ATSC 3 IP and RF analysis, so StreamScope XM from Triveni, a good device. This will tell you everything that's wrong or good with your system. ATSC 3 IP and RF IRD devices. These are devices that take an RF and put out HDSDI. You can feed your monitor wall just like you do with your 1.0 stuff. Make sure you're on the air. Should have a consumer TV so you can see what the viewers see. And there's some IP interconnect between stations, which is typically video flow or LTN. That is provided that you're doing a lighthouse. A lighthouse is the sharing of signals between the 3.0 that's trying to shed their 1.0 signals and the people that are taking them and contributing in HD to the lighthouse in return. Budgetary estimates, I won't go through all this, but I'll say that if you're a 3.0 lighthouse, you should plan on like $200,000 to $250,000. It depends a little bit on channel count and manufacturer choice. It's something that, you know, during the process, we talk about this a lot with customers and try to get the right thing for what they're trying to do. 1.0 estimate, this one is a little bit more fluid. Really, if you have new encoders, you're in pretty good shape. The requirement here is that they have to be able to generally take in an IP transport stream and use that as a source. And they also have to be able to encode AVC for their HD service and send that out IP. So again, new encoders will do that. Old encoders you might have to replace. You're also generally adding a channel or two for channel share. So if you might have to buy extra encode licenses for services, and you're referencing somebody else's PSIP, so a different major channel number, and that might be a charge for your PSIP system. And then the video flow or LTN equipment to get the signals between stations is also part of that. So it might be, you know, as little as, you know, 10 or 15K, it could be as much as, you know, 80K. Here's a basic block diagram of the 3.0 chain. Starting with the encoder at the left, you can have SDI inputs from your local station and IP inputs, which are transport stream over IP, from your partners. And that encoder will send out dash, and that's a dash file for every video, audio, and caption component. It's generally 2 seconds long. It can also stream out OTT dash to a CDN for your OTT stuff. It goes into a signaling server, which could be a dash to route or a dash to MMT conversion. It handles all your NRT data that you want signaled. It handles your AEA, does your broadcast app insertion, and it goes out to your guide data provider like Titan TV or Gracenote or ProTrack and gets the guide data. That happens almost identically to the 1.0. So it puts out a route multicast for every service that you do. If you've got five stations, you'll have five different route multicasts. That goes into a broadcast gateway, and that broadcast gateway is going to mux those multicasts, those route multicasts, or MMT, into an STLTP multicast. In addition to the actual service data, there's going to be all your modulation data. So when that STLTP hits the exciter settings are essentially just putting in the multicast and UDP port, and it adopts all the settings from the stream. There's also some blocks below that are the analyzer and the IRDs, just so you can look at off-air and your IP signals. Just talking a little bit about encoder packager, ATSC3 requires HEVC video and AC4 audio, and I've listed out a couple of nominal bit rates for each, 1080p at 4 to 5 megabits, UHD 16 to 20, maybe a little bit more than that really, 480p about 1 megabit, and then most encoders will do 5.1 AC4 encoding, so you feed it PCM audio embedded in your video and it will take care of that. If you want to do anything over and above that, it's a linear acoustics box right now. It also does dash packaging, so that's where DRM is inserted. It does a conversion of 608 captions to IMSC1 captions, and it can do OTT. Your route and MMT server does dash to route conversion. It does ESG generation, signaling, which is basically PSIP. You know, it puts your short channel name and your major minor channel in there. Broadcast app insertion. It can be two ways. It can be broadband, which is you host the app on a server somewhere, and you put the URL of that server in a table. And any TV that's broadband connected will go out, download it from that server, and use it. You can make it a true broadcast app by hosting the file locally and ingesting that in your route server and sending that data in your broadcast attached to a channel at whatever bit rate you want. 300 kilobits a second, 500, a meg. People have to stay on your channel until they get the whole package. So you want to consider that when you set your bandwidth. AEA insertion, referenced NRT data, and then the certificates go into that server as well. The broadcast gateway or scheduler, again, route to STLTP conversion. Any unreferenced data, anything that you want to be hidden from people and only have, you know, specific receivers be able to use it. ModCod in exciter settings, which includes LDM or layered division multiplexing, which is kind of a cool way to get a very low carrier to noise with a lot more bit rate than you'd normally be able to do. A good example of that would be in Detroit, where we have a minus 2.9 dB carrier noise with about a 2.7 meg throughput. If I were to do that any other way, I'd have about 300 kilobits of data. The drawback to that is that you're basically stealing carrier to noise from your other PLP that has all your audio video services in there. Depends a little bit, but usually about 1 to 2 dB hit on carrier to noise. Market connectivity. So we're going to go over a lighthouse model and some station interconnectivity. This is a lot. I'm not going to go over it real carefully, but a lot of the times the lighthouse will have two stations. And what they'll do is they'll take their HD from the 3.0 and put it onto their other 1.0 station. And they'll send their SDs over to partners as AVC or MPEG-4 services. And in return, the partners will send their HD as an MPEG-4 stream at 20 megabits over to the 3.0 encoder. That's a mezzanine level encode just meant to preserve quality. So a lighthouse station is the one that's going to turn off their 1.0 and go to 3.0. They have to distribute all their legacy 1.0 services to somebody else in the market. Partners are generally going to take at least one of those services, and in return, of course, the partners send HD to Lighthouse. There is a few rules here. If you're sending a stream to somebody else, you need your EAS data in there. You need your legal ID. You need your audio processing. You need your Nielsen. But the station that's receiving your signal is responsible for PSIP, and that works both ways. Station interconnectivity, there's mainly LTN, which is a managed, or OPEX, and VideoFlow, which is hardware that you buy, CapEx. Those are the two main ways to do it. The benefit of those is that they can use two ISPs and two encoder inputs to do redundancy. So they can switch between inputs, and then they can switch between ISPs on their output to make sure that you never drop packets, unless you have two ISP failures, which is pretty unusual. You could also do microwave if you're lucky enough, or fiber, again in Portland. It's one place in the 50 that I've done that had fiber, dark fiber between stations. So now we're going to get into an IP overview. I want to go over a couple of basic rules. So that, you know, an IP address is divided between, you know, network and host partitions. Then there's subnet mask, which is going to really determine your network and your host and how many IP addresses you have available for equipment. And your gateway, which connects local devices to other networks. Then you also have DNS, which is going to resolve domain names. So in ATSC 3, we're doing a lot of, it's almost all multicast. There's a file transfer, the dash, everything else is multicast. And what makes multicast is just the IP address range you use. So that can be 224.0.0.0, and it goes all the way through 239.255.255.255. So if you choose an IP address in that range, you're doing multicast. The chart below just shows the other class A, B, C ranges of unicast. And class C is going to be what most of my examples following this are. And it's really only 254 hosts or different devices you can connect to it. It's just restrictive to that. So some basic IP rules. Unicast, one-to-one, always needs the TX and RX NICs to be within the same subnet. Multicast, which is one-to-many, it doesn't actually need that, but it's really good practice to adhere to that, because it does allow you, if you keep things in the same subnet, to ping between devices to make sure you have physical connectivity. If you don't do that, the ping isn't going to work anyways, and you're going to have to figure it out some other way. And the other thing that's kind of important here is that NICs on the same physical device should really be in different subnets. If you don't do that, the device might not be able to route the traffic out the right NICs. It could get confused. So that's another rule that we want to stick with. Now, these are some of my things that I do to keep things straight, but I like to use the same fourth octet, which would be the last set of IP addresses, for a common piece of equipment, just to have them all the same. So if my control address is at 192.168.12.50, I want to make every other NIC with a different purpose end in .50. It's just easier for me to manage that in my brain. It just keeps track of things better. So in our examples, we're going to have a transport stream over IP, which I write as TS over IP or TSOIP. And that one would be on 192.168.13.50. I'll explain the slash 24, but essentially that's a 255.255.255.0 mask. Route on 192.168.14.50 and STLTP 192.168.15.50. So you can see that that third octet just increments by one and the fourth stays the same. That's going to adhere to all the rules I just talked about. Subnet mask, like I just said, can be written out long, like 255.255.255.0, or you can also see it as a slash 24, and that's called CIDR notation. To understand slash 24, you have to convert the decimal to binary. So if I take 255 and convert it to binary, it's just 8 ones. And then what you do is you count the ones and ignore the zeros. So if 255 equals 8 bits, and you have 3 255s, 8 times 3 is 24. So that's how you get that slash 24 for that subnet. Another example that might be a little more complex would be 255.255.255.192. So if you're going to find the CIDR for that, you already know the 255s equal 24. 192 in binary is 11000000. So you just count that as 2 bits. So 24 plus 2 would be 26. So to go into that just a little bit deeper, for a 24-bit mask, equipment will communicate if their IP addresses have the same first 3 octets and the fourth is different. The 255 in a subnet indicates that you have to match, and the 0 means it has to be different. So if I had a 192.168.12.50 and a 192.168.12.100, everything works fine. If I have a 192.168.12.50 and a 192.168.13.50, I won't work because my third octet is different, and also my fourth octet is the same. Those both are bad situations. So now we want to talk about different networking options. So when we're going to design a system, there are two ways, in my opinion anyways, to do this. So you can either incorporate this multicast address into your existing switches. There's some danger in that. Multicast doesn't really work great on a control network if you don't isolate it. You can't really let it just get into your network. It can flood the backplane and cause problems. Another option, given that, is to have isolated switches for your data traffic. This wouldn't include control. Control would go on the existing network, so you could open your web GUIs, but all your multicast data would be isolated on separate switches. And what we find is that there's about a 50-50 split between customers choosing one way or the other. And groups with really strong or involved IT departments are going to want to use existing switches and try to manage it. And everybody else would want to use an isolated switch. It's actually, in my opinion, it's a safe way to go. There are real no drawbacks to doing that because all of the ATSC3 equipment, test equipment, IRDs, all the actual equipment, they're going to be hooked up to these VLANs in this isolated switch, and you'll have all access to that data through the control interface that you've got on your existing control LAN. You're not really missing out on a lot. So when we do a switch, whether it's an existing customer switch or a new one, we're going to suggest that they use their existing control LAN and make up VLANs for route, STLTP, and transport stream over IP. These are the 3 different kinds of multicast traffic that we have. And a VLAN is really like just a virtual switch. If you take a 24-port switch and you make 3 VLANs, 8 each, you basically have 3 sub-switches. Those VLANs won't let traffic talk in between, so they'll be isolated. Anything on the first 8 ports can talk to each other, but they'll never talk to the other ports. So it's just a way that we've got to configure these up to make sure that the traffic remains isolated and doesn't go anywhere else. So I made up an example of an IP network for 3.0. It's very simplistic. There's many different ways to do this, but this is just a simple example of, you know, what would work. So I have a control VLAN. It's 49 in this example. It's really just going to be my third octet. The VLAN 50 for TS over IP, 51 for route, 52 for STLTP. So this is just another example of the block diagram that I showed before, but I have my switch in there. And my green ports are my transport stream over IP. My blue are my route and dash. And the orange is my STLTP. And you'll see that there's the actual port number one on the top left is red. That's the switch control port. That's actually on the switches VLAN 1. But what happens is LTN and video flow are going to send transport stream over IP services into the switch, and that switch is also connected to the encoder, which allows the encoder to receive that traffic. The encoder puts out it puts out a dash stream that goes into the blue dash route VLAN, and that in turn goes into the input of the route MMT signaling server. That server converts it to route multicast, goes back into that blue VLAN, and goes up in turn into the input of the gateway, which wants that route multicast. The output of that gateway is the yellow or the orange line, that's STLTP. And that's going to get routed over to your exciter. And on the bottom, you can also use IRDs and test equipment like the StreamScope to analyze your route and your STLTP. So that's an isolated switch. You have access to all that data. You don't have to have it on your existing network if you don't want to. So talking about transport stream over IP VLAN, in a Lighthouse model, partners are sending you HD services. It's a transport stream 20 megabits for HD. It's got AC3 5.1 and AC3 SAP, more than likely. It'd be 19 megabits of video, 400 kilobits of 5.1 audio and 200 kilobits of SAP audio and some overhead. So both LTN and video flow are going to have some kind of template for IP addressing. You're just going to have to record that. And this helps keep track of where all the multicast addresses are going without too much trouble. So as an example here, video flow and LTN output NICs and the encoder input NIC want to be in the same subnet. So I did 192.168.50.11 for LTN, .12 for video flow, and .10 for the encoder. Those are going to talk to each other. I can ping all those devices and make sure I actually have connectivity. If I don't get my transport stream over IP, there are things I can do. Because it's multicast, I can receive it from anything, another IRD, a piece of test equipment. So I just connect that test equipment or IRD up to that VLAN, a spare port, and I try to tune it to whatever that UDP address and port number is. If I don't get that, then I can start pinging between devices and find out if I've got some kind of physical problem, like it's not cabled right. It's almost like certain what the problem is. This is a lot to see. I'm not going to go over this one in too much detail, but what I'm showing here is the actual sheet that I use to record IP addresses and what NICs on the devices we use, and also the actual stream multicast address and port numbers and what they contain. So in this case, there's a couple services from LTN and a couple from VideoFlow that hit the encoder, and I've got all the NIC addresses on the right-hand side in that chart. Now, if we go over to the route VLAN, so encoder dash output is the file transfer, not multicast. And the encoder output NIC and the route signaling server's input NIC have to be in the same subnet. This is mandatory because it's a file transfer. There's no multicast here. It wouldn't work if you didn't have that right. So encoder output NIC is going to be on 192.168.51.10, and the signaling server will be on 51.13. The route IO NIC, which is really the output, is ganged. It does input and output is on the same NIC, so it's still 51.13. And the gateway's input NIC is on 51.14. I can ping between all those and find out if I've got good connectivity. If you're not publishing, you do the ping test, make sure it's connected. But the thing with publishing is there's a lot of parameters that you have to match. The destination IP, which would be the route signaling server's NIC, the UDP port that you use. Every manufacturer uses a different one. It's not very convenient, but that's the way it is. And the publishing path, which is syntax reliance, right? If it's capital or lowercase or there's a space or not a space, you have to adhere to all that. And that's generally where the problems are. It's just in the syntax. And here's another diagram showing the path of just route and a chart that shows, exactly what the IP addresses are. STLTP VLAN. So gateway output NIC and the exciter input NIC should be in the same subnet. And again, the example, 192.168.52.14 and 52.15. You can see in each VLAN, we're incrementing the third octet, and the fourth octet is different. Because the broadcast gateway feeds the exciter over some kind of STL, it could be microwave, it could be IP, it's the first thing to look at if there's some problems. And typically, the problem here isn't going to be it doesn't work, it's that it's intermittent, or there's some, you know, some glitches or interruptions. It could be, you know, a microwave bandwidth issue. It could be that you're using an ISP that doesn't handle multicast very well and you need some other equipment to make it work right. But you should be able to ping between your studio equipment and your transmitter equipment and just make sure that you've got basic connectivity. It's also nice to have some equipment that can look at that STLTP at the studio and at the transmitter. So you can look pre-STL and post-STL, and then you've also got your off-air, so you can kind of see where the problems might be that way. A good idea for STL bandwidth is about 35 megabits. And if you're going to use, whether it's public internet or a private ISP, you really need to do something with STLTP to encapsulate it, to make it go through there right. You'll have problems 100% of the time if you just try to treat it like a normal IP signal. So there's quite a few companies that make things. LTN and VideoFlow both handle it. There's some other ones out there as well. But you have to do something special to be able to transport it that way. And again, the chart that shows all the IP addresses and the path through that switch. So that takes care of the physical NIC IP addressing. But there's a part of the spec that actually calls out for a way to do route an STLTP signal multicast. And the reason for this is that when there's more than one transmitter in a market, a TV is going to have access to the multicast you use. If you happen to use a multicast that another station's using, there could be a problem. They're all source filtered. It shouldn't happen that it causes an issue, but it's part of the spec. So we have to try to make route an STLTP unique to your station. So how do you do that? We came up with a way to incorporate, and this isn't like any kind of, you know, rocket science for us, but just a way to incorporate major and minor channel into the UDP multicast address of the UDP port. So we always start off by default at 239.255, and then the major channel dot minor channel, and the port default is base 8000. With a major channel and a minor channel after it. So if our lighthouse station was on 20.1, we'd be 239.255.20.1, port 8201. Nobody else in the market should have that if they adhere to the same rules. Right? 20.1 is yours and nobody else is gonna have it. ESG, we do a slightly different rule there. We do 239.majorchannel.0.255 with a port of 8000. So again, with a 20.1, we'd be 239.20.0.255, port 8000. That keeps the ESG service unique. So sometimes stations have specific octets that their group will give them. So you might be assigned a 10.13. You know, whatever. And that 13 is unique to you. You can incorporate that in here. You might make your address then 239.13.20.1. That is even better because that gives you more uniqueness. So we've got groups that will adopt something like that. STLTP has the same basic rule set. It has to be unique. So we've come up with 239.0.20, or in this case 20.1, major minor. And then the port number again, 8201. And that should keep everything unique for that as well. We think that satisfies the rule set. This is a little hard to read because it got hyperlinked there, but this is just a random example of four stations. You got a 20.1, a 10.1, a 17.1, and a 52.1 for the different networks on the lighthouse. So that dash path is just, you know, That's the format where I was talking about syntax matters, and you have to, you know, go to your destination address with a port number. The route output path is exactly what I talked about, 239.255.major/minor. So you got 20.1, 10.1, and so on and so forth. Same thing with the STLTP address and ESG. The preamble, which you see is 224.0.23.60, 4937 port, that's the one exception. That is that way everywhere. You can think of that as like a PAT always being on zero. That is going to be in every stream. It's preset. That address exists for everyone. You don't get to set it. That's about it for me. What I wanted to say is that Dave Folsom at Perl wrote a Lighthouse manual. I've got a copy of it. Tom put a link in his presentation. If anybody wants it, you can contact me. It's a really good manual. It takes the spec, which I've also put a reference to there, and kind of makes it a little bit easier to go through. And then any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
So the idea that stuff's going out over the air as multicast is fascinating to me. So generally speaking, at least in my experience, when you're setting up multicast delivery and reception on a network, and one example would be video flow equipment. We use video flow for a few different things at our station. And when I'm setting up the video flow equipment, I need to tell the, maybe even some equipment downstream from the video flow, I need to tell it, the receiving device, which multicast IP address a stream is subscribing to.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I'm curious about is how do ATSC 3.0 receivers discover which multicast stream they want to be subscribing to or watching in order to watch a channel? I assume there must be some sort of announcing / discovery process in the kind of bootstrapping when it first looks at a channel.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's exactly it. If I go back to the preamble address, that is preset, but it's also referenced in tables. But you're going to have some table structure that you're going to go through, an SLT, which references a table called SLS. There's an SLS for every channel. And inside those tables, there's references to the multicast addresses that we're using, and also the source addresses. So there's this thing called SSM, a single source multicast filter. So you can use that to make sure that you're not just locking to your multicast, but you're locking to your multicast from a specific NIC address. That happens as well within the tables. You can also do ASM, which is any source, which means basically just look for the multicast address and subscribe to it. Those are the two different ways to do it. But yeah, those tables contain that reference, and that's how the TVs are going to know what to look for. So there's a whole structure that you go through when you tune into the RF and you see your preamble and you get your SLT, and then it shows you your SLSs, and it depends on what major minor that you tune to. That's referenced in those tables as well, which reflects back on a multicast address. So it's kind of like, you know, when you in ATSC 1, when you get your PAT, you get your RF, you get your PAT, it tells you your PMT PID values. Those reference your elementary streams. There's the TVCs also reference, which gives you your major minor channel, and all that works together. It's pretty similar to that, just different. Whatever. Similar.
With your 40 plus installs, do you see most stations add an interactive app like Perl or Sinclair's free app to help viewers find content?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of different apps out there. You know, Perl has this, they call it a bunch of different things, Hello World, but it's really like a audience measurement. Nobody sees it. It operates in the background. When you tune to the channel, the TV that's broadband connected reports back to a server, and it just logs itself as, you know, we looked at your channel. That's a broadcast app that's used a lot. Just not, it's really a broadband app, first of all, I should say. It's not really transmitted in the stream, just the URL is. But that one's done a lot. I know Sinclair does a lot, and indeed they did open source theirs. I think that's great. I've seen other groups like, I don't know if I should mention them, but I'm going to, Gray and Tegna and Nexstar have developed their own apps as well, and we're in the process of putting those out. Not a lot of them went in the early days, except for Sinclair, but I think people are kind of, starting to explore that. And an app, really, the deal there, at least in my mind, is that an app's a program. So what can you do with a program, a computer program? Anything you want to, really. And a TV's a computer. So you just load a program on a computer and off you go. I think it's, just that flexible. It's whatever your imagination takes you. So.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you. Appreciate it.